That's an interesting one. I think it's important. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Thank you. Right.
Good.
Yeah. And we should send flyers out to the different seminaries, just in case you don't see it. Okay. Let's begin. My eyes takes me longer to focus.
Yeah. Need longer arms.
Okay. Here's a reading from John 15. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Live on in my love. You will live in my love if you keep my commandments, even as I have kept my Father's commandments and live in his love. All this I tell you that my joy may be yours, and your joy may be complete. This is my commandment. Love one another as I have loved you. First of all, let me say this is my last session, and I've really enjoyed being here with you all. It's a great thing. And I think one thing we don't do with our priests is to thank them enough as church. You know, the lay people thank us. You know, they're always very grateful and thank us. Because one priest said at his going away party at the parish, he said, if I'd known the people loved you this much, I would have stayed. You know. But I really do thank you as another member of the presbyterate for all the good work that you do. You do touch a lot of people's lives, and your work in ministry is important. I remember, you know, for example, I remember when I was, you don't think about these things until it happens to you. It cut my eye pretty badly in glass and everything. They took me to the hospital. And I was only there for a couple hours. But one of my priest friends came by, and the guy in the rectory stopped by and said hello, and he visited me while I was there. And I remember how grateful I was, for him to do that. And if I was grateful for just being there for a minor accident, how much more grateful are people must be when you visit them when they're really seriously ill, when someone has died. And so, again, I know that people are grateful for the ministry that you do. It's a wonderful thing. Sometimes we forget that. Another thing is that, you know, when we present this stuff, first of all, it's easy for me to present, it's easy to talk about wholeness, sexuality, and all that stuff. And it's easy for me to sound like I've got it all together and I can present my best stuff and walk out, you know. And it makes it sound easy. But I think as all of us start to grapple with these things, we realize how difficult it all is. And at some point, for example, let's look in our handouts at the last page. There's a story in here which, see if I can find it, the spiritual stuff. Page 617 at the top. The top story on page 17. Now, the Baal Shem in this case was one of the real founders and great lights of Hasidic Judaism and the contemplative movement in it. And the Tzaddik is a holy person, a sort of a mystic or enlightened one. The disciples of the Baal Shem heard that a certain man had a great reputation for learning. Some of them wanted to go to him and to find out what he had to teach. The master gave them permission to go, but first they asked him, "And how shall we be able to tell whether he is a true Tzaddik?" The Baal Shem replied, "Ask him to advise you what to do to keep unholy thoughts from disturbing you in your prayers and studies. If he gives you advice, then you will know that he belongs to those who are of no account. For this is a service of people in the world to the very hour of their death, to struggle time and time with the extraneous, and time after time to uplift and fit it into the nature of the divine name. I thought that really captured the struggle that we're in. You know, if someone tells you they've got it all together, this is the solution, they're blowing smoke at you. It's because the very nature of the human experiment, if you will, is the struggle. If you're struggling with your sexuality, if you're sort of working with it, you're on the right road. That's all you really can do. We fall, we get up, but we struggle. That's all we can do. But then the Christian and the religious journey is captured at the end. That in the midst of this struggle, we uplift it and transform it into the nature of the divine name. And we infuse our struggle with the Christian message of forgiveness and hope. You know, I think of St. Luke's, I think of it as a place of hope. When the guys come to us, many times they have no hope. And if they walk out those front doors with a feeling of hope, then you know that treatment has been successful. Because that's one of the greatest gifts we have to give. And a real sign of Christ's presence is the reality of hope. And sometimes we don't even fix whatever it is that needs to be fixed, but they can walk out with hope. And in fact, they've won the war. That's what we need. I remember a priest who I told you earlier about, was an 88-year-old guy, the guy with agoraphobia, and a lot of struggles when it comes to anxiety disorder. He said, you know, this guy had been in therapy forever. He said, you know, I always had this vision that by the end of my life I was going to have conquered all these phobias of mine, and then I would be no longer neurotic. And finally he said, I realized that, you know, I'm going to die being kind of a neurotic guy. And that was a tough moment for him. I said that, you know, I'm going to die in a field with a man, a guy with agoraphobia. I said, no, you thought it right. And that was tough. For him to, he's going to die unfinished. But I think, in fact, all of us die unfinished. We all sort of die with our faults, frailties, and struggle with them. But I think if we struggle with them in hope, and we're on the right direction, that's, in fact, success, where we should be. There's a nice story that, obviously it's just a story, but one story about the bishop who dies and goes to the pearly gates. And says, you know, St. Peter, what do I need to do to get in? St. Peter says, all you need to get into heaven is 100 points. And the bishop says, well, if anybody can get 100 points, I can get 100 points. He says, well, I was the best bishop in the entire country. And that should be worth something. St. Peter says, you're right. You were a great bishop. There are more conversions, more donations, more churches built, more everything in your diocese. You're the best bishop we had. We want you. We're very grateful for the work that you did. And that is 12 points. So, he's a little nervous, but he is more up his sleeve. So he says, well, he said, I was good to my parents. My mother and father were sick for many years. I nursed them and then ushered them into the kingdom. And Peter says, you were right. The angels wept. You were a model son in this busy diocese. And that is 7.5 points. So he goes on and on and on. And finally at the end he says, how many points do I have? He says, you got 22.5. And, well, he says, I don't have anything else. He starts getting more and more nervous, but excited. He says, I don't know what I'm going to do. He said, I could be damned, man. I don't know what I'm going to do. I guess I'll just have to trust in the Lord. And Peter says, ah. He says, that is 100 points. So not that we're finished at the end of our lives, but that somehow we live a life of hope and hope in the Lord. It's okay. So we're all going to die a little messy and a little unfinished. By the way, I found that study. I meant to bring it with me earlier. That Time magazine study I talked to you about that said that the myth is that folks are more likely to masturbate if they don't have a sexual partner. The study, however, said that the people who masturbate the most are the ones who have the most sex. Remember I told you that? And then it was 63% of men and 42% of women have masturbated sometime in the past year. That was from Time magazine. It was October 17th of 1994. So if you're someone who collects data like that, October 17th of 1994, that study was published. I'd like to look for a moment before we go into the boundaries issue is a cave we did. Now, we had a few distractions during our cave meditation, but and a little rock music to boot. When you were in the cave, and before you were sort of communing with the Lord, it was dark, it was alone, it was cold, what were some of the things that you were thinking about or feeling at that moment? Nobody knew you, and what was the feeling with no one knew you were there? What did it feel like? Fear? Someone mentioned fear. Disconnected. Lonely.
Hard, you couldn't breathe here.
Yeah, there's a problems breathing, which I think is one of the most problems, frightening things there is, problems breathing, for me anyway. One of my greatest fears going into this is to die of suffocation. I remember a priest once, true story, a priest was always prayed that he wouldn't die alone, he was afraid of dying alone. Turned out he had a heart attack and died instantly in a big football stadium, a place full of. So I'm gonna die in the open air, you know. I guess that's why I like flying, you know, and jumping. I used to jump too, you know, because you're right out in the air. There's air everywhere. Okay, what else in the cave? Okay, confined. I'm claustrophobic almost. You're stuck, sort of stuck, paralyzed, helpless, hopeless. Good, now we're getting out of it. Unsafe, insecure, sure. Okay. Now, when you start communing with the Lord, there is that sort of communication with God. Communication with God. What was it like then? Either way, what would it feel like? Warm? Warm? Joy? Your way out? A way out of the confinement? Maybe a release or freedom or something? Called freedom or release? Accepted? Oh, pardon me. Whole. Oh, excuse me. Whole. Whole. Okay. Yeah. Cared for. Good. Yeah, that's good. Remember I said in people's spiritual lives, a lot of the guys we get, their spiritual lives are empty. If you ask them the question, they give you the right answers, but they're all coming from the head. And they just, it's just, their spiritual lives are empty. 90% of them, spiritual lives, you guys think they're empty. There's nothing there. Nothing. It's just an emptiness. Disconnected. And so what I say we have to do, we have to, face the truth and pray from the heart. Now, this exercise I gave you is a basic thing of doing that, of a really sort of a contemplative exercise. When you go into the cave is a symbol of yourself. You're alone. You're really moving into your deeper self. And when we do that, what's some of the things that happen to us? We get frightened. We feel stuck. We feel paralyzed. We feel helpless, hopeless. You can't breathe. You feel unsafe. You feel lonely and disconnected. How long are you going to stay there? You're going to get out of there as fast as you can. But the spiritual journey I'm talking about is to move through the darkness, across, if you will, to move through the cave, to move through your inner self, to face the truth and all the muck that's down there. And when we do move through that, we end up with finding God in the center of our very being. When we really move to the, when we pray from the center, pray from our heart, you know, who dwells in the heart of every human being, of course, is God. So we move through this stuff that's us to find God's presence in a deeper way. But if we don't do this, we won't get there. I firmly believe that. If we don't do this, we won't get to there. And the more we do this every day, the more we're willing to sort of face the difficult stuff and step through it, the more we get to God. That was Erickson's idea, by the way. Remember Erickson's different stages? In each one of Erickson's different stages, he said you had to move through, for example, the last stage. You had to move through despair. You had to feel the despair and walk through it before you found the life and the hope. Same thing here. And so the guys at St. Luke's, for example, we have to help them do this. Now, you don't have to do it alone. We walk with them through this. But no one likes to do this. And no one wants to. So you stand on top. This is not me. I'm not this bad stuff. And smile. And you become that priest we talked about. Nice. Everything's nice and wonderful, but it's not real. It's not real. Like the priest who had the AIDS and was not praying. He stopped praying from the crap. He stopped praying from the junk. Moving through the junk and feeling that stuff and then finding life. It's a spiritual journey. And one of the things you see with our graduates when they come back, you see the difference. Every other week, about 10 graduates of ours come back, and you can see the difference in many of their lives. Not all of them, but the ones that do well, you can see they have a deeper sense of peace and joy and connectedness in their life. They look good. You can see it in their faces. It's a wonderful thing to see. I did say we'd talk a bit about boundaries, which I think are important. I won't spend a long time on this. And I'll get back to this stuff in a minute. But this is important, and people are asking me about this. Before the Vatican Council, things have changed a lot since then in terms of boundaries. Before the Vatican Council, a good symbol of that is how we said Mass. The priest faced away from the people. His arms are about this far apart. He looked at the wall. There was a grate between him and the people, or communion rail, and he spoke in a foreign language. And the message to the people was, don't get close. Don't get close. Don't touch me. Stand away. And that's a sort of an unconscious boundary. All those boundaries are there. I'm not saying that's bad, but clearly those boundaries are there. Or as one seminarians came home for the summer, and the pastor stood up and said, now, these seminarians coming, our young boys who are consecrated to God are coming home this summer, and I want you young girls to keep your hands off of them. The church was sort of setting up these boundaries, and they're much clearer. Now, in the post-Vatican II era, the priest turns around, faces the people, the railing's gone, opens his arms, and speaks in the vernacular. The message now is, close, come get me, I'm yours. And of course they do. And so what happens is we used to have external boundaries set for us. Now, things are a little bit clearer. Here's what you can do, here's what you can't do, here's how close you can get to the priest, here's how you can't, and everything was set. And your mother couldn't sit in the front seat, right? She had to sit in the back seat. All those issues. I'm not saying that's bad, I'm just saying that's the way it was. The church set up for us more external boundaries. But that's not the way it is anymore. And so what we have to do now is to set up internal boundaries. We have to set up our own boundaries. You know, in the rectory I was in, you know, in the post-Vatican II rectory, I mean, there are people in my apartment, I was upstairs, they're knocking on my bathroom door. I mean, the first rectory I was in, you know, people were everywhere. And so we have to set up our own boundaries. And that's tough, I think, especially for seminarians, to expect a 26-year-old guy to set up boundaries, effective boundaries, for 3,000 people is suicide. But that's the way the system is. It's much easier with me. We're doing therapy, for example. I can say to you, look, you're coming in at 3. I want you to leave at 3:50. Not 3:51. And don't call me unless it's an emergency. And the boundaries are set. Not so with you. Part of the very ministry of a priest is to live among the people and to work with the people. Especially the diocesan priest. That really is part of the charism of the diocesan priest. To live among the people and to be one of them. We are one of the people. Let's say, I'm a secular priest. Emphasis on the word secular. We are part of them. There's very little. So anyway, you have to set up the boundaries and you have to know what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do. If an attractive woman, if you're heterosexual, attractive woman invites you out for dinner at her place 11 o'clock at night, are you going to do that? Well, you might not, but you ought to know the answer ahead of time. And all these sort of boundaries are important. And there's also a little snare that you're talking about, some of the little snags and snares. For example, you're the new pastor on the block, you walk in, and the first thing that happens to you in the first week, a woman comes up to you and says, you know, the last pastor was this mean person. He would never come over to my house for dinner, but I'm sure you're not going to be like him. You know? It's a very seductive line. There are all sorts of seductive things going on all the time. I remember doing therapy. There's this woman who had her chair. You know, my chair is in one spot. Her chair is in another spot. And, you know, it's like I noticed that every week her chair moved about that far, a little bit closer. And after about, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 weeks, this is getting noticeable. So being this highly trained professional that I am, I said, I noticed that your chair is moving closer to my chair. Saying the obvious, which you don't always do. It took me 4 years to learn how to say the obvious. I noticed your chair is moving closer to mine. Ha! Huh. She got all upset. It's just, oh, she said, well, I just wanted to see the clock. I said, well, you can see the clock from back there. Move it back, and you and I will talk about, you know, why your chair might be moving closer to mine. She quit therapy 2 weeks later. No, it was just too much. So, it's easier for me as a therapist to set boundaries like that because our profession sets them more clearly. It's not so easy for you. And if you're a nice, warm, caring priest, and someone comes up and gives you one of these, are you going to do that? Well, maybe you will, and maybe you'll say, oh, don't touch me. You know? There's a lot of ways in which it's a struggle for you to set boundaries that you feel comfortable with. Now, in your handouts, but you can read them later, there are different... Well, I would definitely hug her. Brooke Shields said, what do you do if Brooke Shields wants to hug you? I'd give her a nice hug. Have you? You've hugged Brooke Shields? Great. Really? These days? Wait till she's 18. Yeah. I was gonna say I'll give you my card, you call. that takes your breath away. Setting boundaries is a very difficult thing. It requires an enormous degree of emotional maturity to do it. And I think it's one of the things that we're not helping our seminarians, young priests with. It's a jungle out there. Remember another client, for example, she always came in with a significant other male. And one time, he didn't show up. Now, she was in her 50s, very attractive. And the one time, she always wore this shirt up to her, buttoned up to her, you know, Adam's apple. And the one time he doesn't show up, she wears this very low-cut dress. Very, very low-cut dress. So the whole session leaned over like this. You know, I talked the other day about us giving unconscious messages to people, seducing people. And priests and all of us do flirt a little bit, and sometimes we're not even aware of it. And I'm hoping that we become more conscious of our sexual messages. But at other times, people will be flirting with us. And we should sense when that's happening and make some conscious decisions around it. First of all, it's flattering. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but we should be aware of what's going on. And, if you're in someone's house, alone at night with somebody who's fine, attractive, it's 11 o'clock at night, both of you a little bit loaded, you probably are in a tight spot. You know, probably are in a tight spot. Many times the guys will say to us, oh, if I just didn't have done that, you know, I'd be okay. But he didn't recognize all the things he had done that got himself into the position in which he could not recover. I'll go through some, here's some things. This is thanks to Frank McNulty and Pat Livingston, a few adjustments I've made. These are in your handouts also, but I'll go through them. Some of the, if you're in a relationship with someone, and you might want to say, well, is this a positive, celibate relationship or not? How can I tell? Here's some things to look at. Because it's not so clear. Before, when one of the priests was telling me about no significant relationships, it was easy. Anything that's close and warm, forget it. Now everybody's telling you, hey, you got to have warm relationships. That's now the question is it, that's not such a clear thing anymore. Now, how close can I get? Obviously, the woman can ride now in the front seat. Can we go on a vacation together? Interesting question. Can I go on a vacation together with someone I find attractive? I know a priest friend of mine went on a vacation with a woman, spent 2 weeks in Paris along with this woman. But no one batted an eyelash because everyone knew he was gay and no one cared. You know? But, you know, if a heterosexual guy spent 2 weeks on a vacation with a woman alone in Paris, well, you know, kind of a touchy, it's a touchy thing. Boundaries. Okay, boundaries, that's important. I want to use boundaries in a positive sense, because most people, especially church authorities, when we talk about boundaries, they're saying keeping people out. Boundaries means don't do this, don't do that. I don't mean that by boundaries. The context I want to use is life-giving relationships that are healthy for you, not smothering. So, if you're a rigid guy, as I said in the thing, in the handouts, you're going to have a very stiff boundary. No one's going to get in, and no one's going to get out. And you can be a very distant person. Now, some people have rigid boundaries by smiling all the time. They keep everybody away. Some people do it by being angry. There's angry people that keeps people away. Some people are just disengaged. But all those are rigid boundaries. People don't get in. The problem with that is, if people don't get in, you're not nurtured, and you're going to say, I'm giving more ministry than I'm getting. If you feel like you're giving more than ministry than you're getting all the time, you're going to burn out for sure. Because you're constantly pumping out stuff and you're not getting anything back. That's a real point. I think people who do well in ministry at the end say, I got more out of ministry than I ever gave. That, if you feel that way, you're doing fine. Now, all of us get tired, whatever, but fundamentally, as you look back at your ministry, you ought to say, no, I got a lot more than I ever gave. I think we do. So, here's a rigid boundary. Now, what I use as an example of that is the human skin as a boundary. If the skin in your body, if it's all painted, if you paint every bit of it and cover it all up, and you'll die. Because the skin has to breathe. There has to be air going through the skin. So, the skin kind of is a porous, sort of is a membrane that allows air or whatever to go in. So, if it's too rigid, you're going to die. Your skin. Now, the other extreme is that it's too porous. If your skin isn't strong enough and firm enough, you won't hold your body together. You just on the floor, you know, and you won't really be an identifiable human being. And there's some people who don't have boundaries. They're like everything to everybody, but they're nothing to themselves. They don't have an identity. They're a liberal today and a conservative tomorrow, and happy, and they're what everybody else is around them. Kind of like codependent extreme. You know? They don't have a boundary around themselves. The old joke was, a codependent someone, the moment of their death, someone else's life flashes in front of their eyes. You ought to have your own life, your own identity. Who are you? Terrible. These jokes are being recorded too. They're terrible. So anyway, a porous person has no identity, you know? But you do have it. You know, you're a person. You've got your identity. You're happy sometimes. Sometimes it makes you sad. Sometimes things you like. Sometimes you don't like. So, too porous, and everyone's your best friend. Everyone's your best friend. You're everything to everybody, and therefore you're nothing to anybody. And if you don't have a minute of your own time, and everyone's all over your space, you're pretty porous. Now, newly ordained tend to be like this because of the initial enthusiasm of ministry, and that's okay. I mean, we all go through periods of that. But eventually, if you stay like that, you're going to burn out real quick. Now, what you're really looking for is someone with flexible boundaries. And this is when you're talking about your whole sense of identity, so it's a sense of identity as who you are as a human being, and thus how you relate to others. It's a very broad psychological concept. And so that's what we're looking for. And another example of flexible boundaries, as I said before, you're going to be close with some people. There's going to be a few people that really know you and are your close friends. When you're not feeling too good, they're the people you're going to call on. When you're tired, depressed, lonely, whatever, these are the people you're going to call. When you want to go out and have fun, they're the people you're going to call. There are other people that are not quite as close to you. You'll know them. You'll go out to dinner with them maybe once in a while. You'll do something fun with them, but they're not quite as close as that. And then there are many acquaintances that we all have. So you'll have varying degrees of intensity of relationships depending on who the person is and how you relate to them. That's another good sign of flexible boundaries. A lot of this stuff, anyone who's been in ministry for 25 years, most of this stuff you guys are doing probably unconsciously. You learned it. Yeah, you just learned it. You learned it from good pastors before you. You just learned it. Well, you don't know what works and what doesn't work. This, I hope, makes it just a little bit more explicit so you can see perhaps some of the things you've learned being in ministry. And I think some of the guys who don't make it in ministry somehow didn't learn these things. Okay. Is it a positive relationship? If you're, for example, time and energy, if you're spending an enormous amount of time with one person and it's kind of sucking up all your energy, it's probably too much. You should be spending quite a bit of time with your close friend, but if you got one friend and you're spending all your time with that person, you got these in your handouts, by the way, so what page are they on? 11. So you don't need to write them down. Okay. That's time and energy. So look at how much time and energy you're spending. If it's too much, I think like a couple, you know, sometimes priests will have relationships with women or men, whatever their orientation is, and there might not be any sex going on, but they're acting like a couple. They go out to dinner all the time. They go on vacations together. They spend all their time together. They might as well be married. You know, they're doing everything but. That probably is an exclusive coupled relationship. And I think it's a little much. Now, people disagree with me. This is my personal opinion. Feel free to disagree. The question of scandal, too. We are public people. Guys don't like that, but we have a certain responsibility as public figures. And if this relationship became public, would it cause a scandal? Now, there are always some people who don't understand priests having need for friends. And that's their problem. But if this relationship that you're in would cause a scandal, people knew about it, you ought to think about that. Why is that? Think about it. Status of the other person. Is the other person an appropriate friend? If the person is, say, another priest, if the person is someone from the parish, a sister, a brother, a married couple, whatever, that's one thing. If the person is your spiritual directee, they're already in a very vulnerable relationship with you. You should be careful about having friends who are spiritual directees or parishioners. That, you can have them, but it gets a little bit more dicey. Who is this person? Can this person really have a real relationship with me? A real free relationship where they can say what they need to say to me. That's the self. How about you? Are you at a particularly vulnerable point? If you're in a real vulnerable point, if you're having a relationship with someone who is very sexually attracted to you, for example, that makes you very vulnerable to engage because you're going to be looking for more comfort than you normally would. So what the people, the psychologists, for example, who tend to get into sexual relationships with their clients tend to be males who are lonely and isolated in their 40s and 50s. Midlife males who are isolated. They tend to be the most high-risk group for inappropriate relationships with a therapist, counselors. It's going to be the same with us. Okay, physical contact. Basically what this talks about is, you know, it's important for us to have physical contact. We all know that. But there are certain types of physical contact which really expressly lead to genital intimacy. Sometimes the guys will say to me, well, I touched this guy here or there, but kid or whatever, but or this woman there or whatever, but it wasn't really sex. It was education, it was this, it was that, that sort of thing. And I say, well, look, I want you to know something. You may call it that, but when you put your hand on someone's genitals, I want you to know that the rest of the world is going to call this a sexual act. So as I say it, but when I get a little more sarcastic, I say, you know, if it looks like a duck, it quacks like a duck, it walks like a duck, it's probably a duck. You may want to call it a goose, but it's a duck. You know? So anyway, terrible, isn't it? The other psychologist gives me a hard time. There's a little clinical insights. If it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. You can call it what you like. Everyone else is going to call this, you know, some sexual duck.
Here it goes.
And a good thing that we hate to do is to have someone look at their relationship with us. Remember what St. Bernard said, the man who directs himself is being directed by a fool. It's true. I think it's great to have a spiritual director. Everyone says, I can't find a good one. You don't need a perfect one. You just need somebody who can help you. Or if you're in therapy, wherever you're in. I think it's good for us as helpers, helping people, to have people help us. So I do recommend it. I know most priests are not in spiritual directions, but I do encourage you to find a director if you can. It's a bit of an investment, time and energy. When I say direction, I usually don't mean having dinner with a friend. That's a good thing. I'm talking about a more formal relationship. You don't have to, but especially if you're going through a difficult time. If you're thinking about leaving the priesthood or making a tough decision or you're looking at a relationship, if you're going through a tough time, I would especially say try to find someone as a helper. So there are just some thoughts. Thanks to Pat Livingston and Franklin Felty. Yes. It can be difficult. You talked about the deep, effective relationships with people not committed to celibacy. It can be difficult. For example, if you, let's say you're heterosexual and you have a close relationship with a single woman. If you do that, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but we should be careful because if she is also someone who's open to marriage, if you're taking all of her time and energy and you know, that sort of thing, you're really taking her out of circulation. And so you should be careful about that. Because she really needs to spend a lot of her energy looking for a mate, if that's what her vocation is. And also the question of expectations. That's true of any sort of friendship. If you expect this much of a relationship, the other guy expects this much, then you're going to have a problem. It's especially true when you have people who are sexually attracted to each other. I remember I had a friend who was just another priest, but he got mad at me for not calling him every day. And he expected that he and I were going to be in touch every day. Well, that's okay, that's him, but I wasn't going to do that. Well, once a week was fine with me to talk to her, spend time with her friends. I mean, that's pretty much what I had expected. So our expectations were not going to mesh, and they just didn't. The relationship fell apart. I think any time we engage in a friendship, we have to sort of negotiate what we're going to do, what we're not going to do. And if the sexuality thing gets into it, it makes it even a little bit more something to work it out. But we talk about all the dangers of it, but I'm one of those guys who believes, you know, in the importance of having a variety of friendships, including those that we find attractive. You know, I think it's a good thing. But there are certain things to be concerned about and to be aware of. And that hopefully that chart will give you some things. Now, I'd like to go through this Sometimes, remember I said that one who directs himself being directed by a fool. Sometimes we get ourselves in difficulties we're not even aware of it. We are our own worst judge. Because we're sort of blind to a lot of things in our own life. We have our own Achilles heel, if you will. Tell the story of a priest who, in this one parish, they had 12 associates in 11 years. 12 associates in 11 years. So, the 12th guy leaves, and the chancery gathers to decide what to do about this parish. So, after serious thinking and meditation, what do you think they decided to do after the 12th guy left? Send in another one. So, they decide to send in number 13. So, I'm sorry, Greg. He's working the chancery. Different chancery, though. Yeah. So, in comes number 13. Now, this the guy they sent in was a very spiritual guy. He really was. He's a great guy, and I liked him. And he said that he would go anywhere that died. He would leave it up to the personnel director, and he would take whatever they ever wanted to send him. This is a wonderful spiritual thing. The problem with that is that everyone else is jockeying for an assignment in the new personnel system. So he ends up with the last assignment left, which is this parish. So he goes into this parish. He lasts for 6 years. The entire assignment for 6 years. And remember, everyone else left in less than a year. And now, when you asked him how it was going, he said it was fine. Fine, nice, everything's good. Really? Yes, everything's great. Everything's fine. So he finishes his 6 years, and what does he do? Kills the bastard, no. Comes to St. Luke's, no. Neither of those things. Probably should have. That would have been healthier. So he leaves the priesthood, is infatuated thing with this young teenage girl, and then 6 months later marries a woman, here's a guy whose life is slowly walking out of control, and he's not aware of it. Now, there is a way in which we, especially as males, I think even more than females, tend to funnel all of our needs into genital sex. We have lots of needs in our lives. You can think of all the needs for affirmation, the needs for love, the needs for caring, of meaning, respected. You can think of it just dozens of needs that we have in our lives. And when all these things don't get met, things slowly get more and more out of control, and there's a way in which some males tend to funnel all those needs into genital sex. So what happens is, the lives get more and more out of control, and then they act out sexually. Now, there are other things that priests can do, too, and males can do. We can name some besides it. Alcohol, beat drums, workaholism, what? Eating, TV, some guy's vegetable on the TV. Surf the net forever. You can think of gambling, you can think of a variety of these things like that. But especially males are sensitive to genital sex. Guess what happened to him? All of his needs got more and more out of control until finally you start getting compulsive when it comes to sexuality. Now our guys tend to do that, St. Luke's, that many of them say, well, gee, if I just didn't touch this guy, this kid, I would have been okay. But no. Your problems were just a whole lifestyle that got you to that one act. So what we need to do is change this whole lifestyle of yours. Now, my brother was an F-16 pilot, and he was part of the test program. Now, in the test program, you put the plane through its paces to see what's wrong with it, because there's always going to be a few things wrong with it. And that's just the way test programs are. So there was one design malfunction in an F-16, and it's true. If you had a fuel imbalance and you rocked your wings, the plane would go out of control. And it's just a design flaw. So it's in the black boxes. So my brother was over the range in Nevada, and they were doing some aerial stuff, And he had a fuel imbalance. He sucked more fuel in one tank than the other, which is not uncommon. And to break off an aerial engagement, you rock your wings. That lets the other guy know it's time to quit. So they're doing their thing. He rocks his wings, and of course the plane goes out of control. It pitches down by itself. He never touched the plane. Pitches back up. No, first of all, pitched up first, pitched down, pitched back up again, zoomed, flamed out. So the engine stops, and then it goes into this flat falling knee. like this. Now, when you're in a falling leaf in a dead stall and your engine's out in an F-16 or any type of fighter, you know, you got no, you're going nowhere. He's under 10,000 feet. At that point, as I told him, you had two choices. The plane's going to crash with you, or the plane's going to crash without you. But the plane's going to crash. So, he punches out. The plane crashes into the desert floor. It's 4,000 pounds of fuel. Blows up this enormous fireball. So his chute opens. And, now unfortunately, fireballs consume oxygen. And what happens is it starts sucking the canopy into more than one guy that's fried by his own fireball. So it starts sucking him in. So my brother had a lot of jumps. We both did a lot of parachute jumping. So he turned his canopy smart away from the fire and tried to track away. But as he looked back, he could tell it was still sucking him back into the flame. This is a three visual spatial relationship. You can see it. You're being sucked back into the thing. So does a very gutsy thing. Turns his canopy towards the flames and goes over the top of it, right through the smoke, and lands on the other side. Now, that was a gutsy move. And thank God he's still around. But if it had been anybody else, they would have been toast. Thank God he's alive. Now, in the accident report, it said that the pilot was in a position from which he could not recover. That is, if you're below 10,000 feet in a flat stall, you're not going to get the plane flying again. You're just not going to do it. You can't get the nose over, restart the engine, and fly again in less than 10,000 feet. You just drop it. You know? So that's true of a lot of our guys, too. They get themselves into positions from which they cannot recover. It's too late. When your whole life's out of control, after 5 years and 10 months of being in that parish, it's too late. You know, he needed to do some things right in the beginning to straighten it out. And so he get more and more out of control, and pretty soon, something's going to happen. Whatever it is, it's going to be ugly. So what we teach our guys at our place is to learn what we call budding signs. Budding signs. Signs in your life that things are going out of control. So I want you to think right now of your own life. Think in your own life, what's one good sign that you have when you know that things are not going well for you? Think of one. You start getting negative. What about you? Get moody. Depression. Not sleeping, irritable. You lose interest. You're apathetic. Stop praying. You're losing your energy. Pardon me? Get lifeless. You don't share. You're just not, you're withholding. You're more withdrawn. Sure. Yeah, you start becoming more and more sucked into things that you don't really want to be. Some people get suicidal. Well, any sort of escapism activity. Work more on your golf game, surf the net, whatever. Yeah. Yes. Pardon me? You become more critical. Again, you lose interest, become apathetic. Some people drink more, you bet. Start feeling sorry for themselves. No one loves you, don't you? Yeah? Resent the people? Every one of us is a little bit different. When I was in the Air Force, they put us through an altitude chamber. And they put us in the chamber, and they took it up to, I don't know how high it was, maybe 25,000 feet or so. And then we were wearing an oxygen mask. And then we'd take the oxygen mask off. And then we developed these symptoms of hypoxia. You know, we weren't getting enough oxygen, 25,000 feet, whatever it was. And so they'd let you do that for a couple minutes. And they wanted you to write down what your symptoms were. I got lightheaded. I couldn't think. I thought everything was very funny, you know. And some people can't concentrate. Everyone has their own types of symptoms. They want you to know what your symptoms are because everyone's a little bit different. And hypoxia is a deadly killer for a pilot because if you're not getting enough oxygen, your judgment goes and you're going to crash. My other brother was also a pilot, by the way. He was a C-130 pilot, four-engine transport. So he was flying out of Peru. And the airport was about 10 or 12,000 feet above sea level. So he and the co-pilot take off, and they're climbing out to get up above the mountains so they could, you know, so they're at about 18, 20,000 feet and climbing, trying to get above the mountains. So They're climbing along in the middle of the day, and my brother looks at the co-pilot and says, you know, it is really dark in here. And the guy goes, yeah, it's dark in here. Yeah, I wonder why it's so dark in here. And he goes, oh, I forgot to pressurize the cabin. So, turn on the oxygen. Forgot to pressurize the cabin. He was getting hypoxic. And when you get, and one of the symptoms of hypoxia is you start to gray out. You start to lose your vision. Everything starts getting dark. Well, the only reason he knew that was he knew what his own symptoms of hypoxia were, and it didn't kill him. Now, the same thing with us. You know what your symptoms of burnout and getting out of control are. All of us get to that point. You work too hard, Lent's a long Lent. You get to Good Friday because, you know, things are tired. Go through all those weddings and things in June and all those graduations, scream. And then you get a little bit beat. And you start seeing these symptoms. And then you say to yourself, ah, I'm not doing too well. I need to back off. And that's what a healthy person does. Our guys at St. Luke's don't know that yet. So we try to teach them that. You all get to those budding signs, then it's time to back off. I was thinking one of the things that I do. When I start getting really too frazzled, I go on what I know is my main work day. I work just as, to the minimum amount I can. You know, at St. Luke's, I'll go in at 9, which is late for me. I'll leave at 4:30 or earlier. I won't do any work at night. I'll take as much time off as I can. I'll only do those things I have to do to keep the ship afloat for a while until I start feeling a little bit better. You gotta have your own way of coping when things aren't going too well. You may or may not be able to take a vacation, but you can take these in-house vacations. That's what I call sort of an in-house vacation. Really kind of treat yourself well. I go to a movie at night, which I don't always do. Or to dinner, whatever. Whatever you need to do, take care of yourself when you're getting a little stressed. We all do it. We recognize it. And then we flip on the oxygen. We need a little more air. We don't suffocate. Budding signs. It's real important. I'd like to pick up a couple of pieces, and then we'll talk some more spirituality stuff. The first thing is the place of psychology. Ray Kemp's next door. Ray's got an interesting line. He said, you know, he said, in the last 5 years, we've been teaching all of our priests psychobabble, and I'm sure they're better off for it. Now, I thought it was interesting. You know, Ray's a guy who shoots from the hip and tells you exactly how he feels. I thought there was some truth to that. I think we need to rightly judge the place of psychology in our faith. Certainly in the 60s and the 70s, we oversold psychology. We thought we'd send someone to St. Luke's, they'd be cured forever, and psychology was a new religion, you know, as Paul Vitz would say. And somehow psychology was going to save everybody. And some entire, for example, trial monasteries used to empty out, they'd send everybody into therapy. That is one extreme, I think. We went through a sort of initial blush where psychology was a new religion. That's one extreme. The other extreme is, I think, a little more prevalent than you're starting to see more of it today. Praying will go away. So the praying will go away thing. And every once in a while, for example, this happened recently where some bishop, I won't say who, but he was kind of poo-pooing all this stuff. He just said all this sexual abuse stuff, all the crap. He said, he just kind of poo-pooed the whole thing. And one cardinal said, you wait till his first couple of cases, he'll straighten up. So there is the other extreme of just saying that the whole thing is just junk. I think psychology, to me anyway, is a secular science, first of all. It's not theology. It's a secular science. Like philosophy, biology, whatever, it's a secular science. It has something to teach us, who are those who work in the field of theology, and those of us who work in the Christian faith. And like Thomas, who baptized Aristotelian philosophy, a lot of us are trying to baptize certain parts of psychology and bring it into the Christian perspective. It does illuminate certain things, as we've been doing yesterday and today. So psychology is important for us, but it limps in a certain respect. And I think where it really limps, when we talk about vocation and talk about celibacy. To me, psychology cannot grasp the concept of vocation, nor can it grasp the concept of celibacy. Because they think everybody should be out there masturbating, and they don't understand why someone would want to live a celibate life. And it shouldn't make sense to psychology because celibacy and vocation are primarily spiritual concepts. They're spiritual Christian concepts. They're not psychological terms. You know, Psychology can help us understand it a little bit, but it'll never grasp the fullness of the celibate life or the Christian concept of sexuality, because it is a spiritual reality. There are branches now. It used to be, of course, Freud himself. I think Freud was a genius, by the way, and I think Freud had some very important things to say to us. But by the same token, he thought religion was a neurosis, you know. And but you see today, what you're getting at more in psychology, there is more of a recognition of the place of religion. For example, I belong to the American Psych Association, and there is one division for the psychology of religion. So there is even a small subset which recognizes the validity of religion. The whole field of, say, transpersonal psychologies are recognizing the spiritual in some sense. So I think there's some good things happening in psychology today along those lines. So I would not want to see us go to either extreme. You know, let's use it when it helps us, because it does illuminate the things. but in the end, it can't grasp a spiritual concept. Now, when I ask guys why they're celibate, I almost always get the same answer. First question I ask them, why are you celibate? And the first thing they say is, the church makes me. And the first thing they say, oh, that's true. That's true. And then I say, yeah, but is there anything else? And then they'll think for a while and they'll say, it makes me more available to ministry. I think that's true too. But both of them are extrinsic reasons. They're things outside you. It helps other people or their external rules. My challenge to you is to say, why is it that we are celibate for ourselves? You know, Jesus said if you give up something, nothing that you give up will not be replaced 100-fold. There is something about this life which has its own giftedness to it. And I think that we're never going to be happy and alive without recognizing that. I think this is where psychology is not going to help us too much, anyway, because I think the reality is going to be a spiritual answer. And I think for each one of us, it's going to be different. I'm not going to give you my answer. I think for each one of us, it's going to be an internal answer. And it's going to be grounded in our spiritual lives, because that's where the answer is going to come. That's why I think it's so critical to live an authentic, as best we can, a spiritual life. Because that's what infuses vocation, call, and a celibate life with life. And not just a denial of something. I noticed, I was walking yesterday down the beach, and I noticed what I thought was, before I do that, let me say something about that. But the struggle for celibacy, also, there's a declining support for celibacy. You knew this, but I just wanted to say it myself, that there is, if you look at people, support for mandatory celibacy, it's going down in this country. Right now, for those over 50 years old, active Catholics now, 35% support mandatory celibacy. That's one-third of active Catholics. Under 50 years old is 25%. So it's dropping. And if you look among priests, they themselves, if you look about priest support for celibacy, I think it's like 50-some-odd percent of those who are over 50 support it. And those under 50, I think it's about 38 or 39%, somewhere around that. So actually, even among ourselves, the support for celibacy is dropping, mandatory celibacy. Now, this is going to be critical because many times guys, they're really honest, will say, Steve, I don't believe that I'm called to live a celibate life. I don't believe it. There are probably some of you here who question that or don't believe it. And then the next thing they ask me, they say, Can I live an authentic life as a priest, or is it going to warp me if I don't believe in this? Well, I think all of us struggle with understanding a call to the celibate life and sexuality. So I think all of us are on that struggle journey. But I would say if you fundamentally thought that you're not called, I think you can live an authentic life. And there's a lot of guys in that category who do, who live good, holy lives as priests, who don't feel called to celibacy. But I would say it's going to cause you some internal tension, which you already feel, and I don't have to tell you that. You're going to feel more tension than maybe someone who does feel called. I think it's a struggle. And I think if you don't feel called to it, and everyone else says they don't think you're called to it, I think we're going to find more guys who are much more likely to be acting out sexually. If you don't feel called to it, and everybody else says you're not called to it, why should you do it? You know, that's why I think one reason why that group is more susceptible to being more sexually active. But again, I would say, like as I said earlier, I think it's an answer that each one of us keep struggling with and keep working on and come up with new answers as we get older. But in no time, I think priesthood is becoming more countercultural than it ever was. People think you're nuts to be celibate. It's not a good deal anymore, from what I can tell. It used to be a good deal, I think, when, especially being a bishop, they say it used to be a good deal, too. But in terms of human rewards, being a priest is not much of a good deal anymore. Not, certainly not in this country. You can do a lot better on the outside. Yes? Yeah. It's a tough job. It's a life sentence to being a bishop. Sure, you know, it's a tough job. In many ways, it's countercultural more than ever to be a priest in this country. You really are sort of standing up against a stiff breeze. And I think it's a real purification that's going on in the priesthood today. Because it's taking away a lot of the human reasons for wanting to become a priest and really making us find a real call from God, I think. This is my personal belief. I think it really does make us plummet the spiritualness of what it means to be a priest. You know? You can't get rich being a priest anymore. You used to be able to. You know, if you got to do a rich parish, you know, a Christmas collection, you could do okay with that. You know? But now everybody's got the same pay scale. You know? Everybody got the same thing. It used to be kind of, you know, you were really respected and loved and, you know, revered society. Well, a little bit now, but not like it was. And it used to be, you know, if you got to be 50 years old, you got yourself a nice pastorate, or 60 years old, you kind of were semi-retiring all the associates were doing. Well, now the guys tell me they're working harder at 65 than they were at 35. You know? So, the humanness, the human good deals, I think, in priesthood are disappearing. So I think what's left is a real challenge to spiritually, connect with this vocation that's ours. And I think it's a real purification. No, but if... good predictors for living a celibate, healthy lifestyle. No, there isn't, Paul, but if you get one, I want you to call me immediately. Because...